Welcome to Season 5. This episode, we have the marvellous Dr. Sarah Wickham back in the cauldron with us. So let me tell you what we're talking about in this episode. You are in for a real treat as Sarah takes us on a look through her newly released book, Plus Size Pregnancy. Oh my goodness, you are going to want to get your hands on this book. Sarah talks to us about how women and families want, need, and deserve better answers to their many questions about higher BMI and birth, and that midwives and birth workers need to know what the evidence says. Sarah clarifies what is the BMI index, and as Sarah says, it's a racist, sexist, and classist index created for completely different reasons than for health. We look at why a higher BMI comes with so many tests and limitations for birth, and Sarah talks us through the existing evidence. Are women with a higher BMI more at risk of cesarean section? And if so, what are the real reasons behind this? Sarah tells us why the phrase morbid obesity is utter nonsense and rooted in a much darker context. And Sarah delves into diet culture, its myths, and the marketing behind it, weight bias and fat shaming in healthcare, and why using BMI is problematic in maternity care. You'll hear all this and much, much more in this fabulous episode. So you know the drill. Tie up your shoelaces, put the dog on a leash, or sit down with a nice cuppa to enjoy this episode of The Midwife's Cauldron. I'm Katie James, and this is the Midwives Cauldron podcast. Each episode, I'm joined by my incredible co-host, Dr. Rachel Reed. Listen in as we hubble, bubble, toil and trouble our way through aspects of womanhood, midwifery, birth and lactation. So go on, subscribe now, and hear us on your favourite podcast host. But just a sec, before we start on this epic episode, if you love the show and want more from Rachel and me, then head on over to our website and check out all the courses, books, collectives a go-go. You'll find all the details and occasional discount deals on the old Instagram at The Midwife's Cauldron, or, of course, in the show notes below. And if you really, really love the show, please consider two things: a single or a monthly donation over on Patreon, or even buy me a coffee. And remember, that review you leave on your podcast host really makes a difference in who listens in. Thank you for your support. We just love having you bubbling away with us. Sarah Wickham, welcome back to the cauldron. You are here for the third time.
And it's a hat trick.
It's a hat trick. Oh, lovely. We should all be wearing hats and have tricks up our sleeves.
That's not what a hat trick is.
Exactly. Yeah. But welcome to the Bubbling Cauldron, and we have you back for a very important reason, and that is that you are releasing a new book called Plus Size Pregnancy, and the cat is out of the bag, and we have brought you in to tell us a little bit more about it.
Katie, thank you so much. It's lovely to see you both.
Oh, wonderful to have you here.
So the question I wanted to ask, because this has kind of been bubbling for a while and we've had conversations for a bit kind of as this book bubbled up to the surface, why did you decide to write this particular book?
Okay, I like this question. This is an easy question, thank you. Because, so in a nutshell, women and families want and need and deserve better answers to their many, many questions about higher BMI and birth. And midwives and birth workers need to know what the evidence says as well. Because as you both know, probably most of your listeners know, at the moment, anyone who has a BMI above what is perceived to be average they get told that they need extra tests and interventions, and they might, they'll probably also find that some options aren't available to them at a certain BMI, midwifery-led units, giving birth in a water pool. But, you know, what's the basis for that? What is the evidence? And I've heard lots of people ranting about this over the years, as well they should. In fact, I first ranted about this in the literature in a midwifery journal in about 2009. So this has been an issue for a long time. But I think after I'd finished In Your Own Time, I had a rest, which I know you didn't believe me, but I did have a rest. And then I thought, it sort of, I just kept hearing from women and families who were, whose care and experience was being really poorly affected by this issue. And it made me realise, you know, there isn't a book which takes you through all of the evidence relating to all of the things that you might be offered if you have a higher BMI, all of the things that are mentioned in the guidelines. That was actually my starting point, was to go to the guidelines and say, what is actually being offered? Because those are the things that everyone needs to know about. And there was no one place to find that evidence, or to find a discussion of the wider context of that evidence as well. And now there is. That's why I decided to write the book. And of course, what I discovered is that there are so many questions and myths and assumptions, as well as just the evidence. You know, like, is there a direct link between BMI and health? This is the assumption. But is there evidence for that link? No. You know, are women with a higher BMI genuinely at higher risk? And if so, of what? You know, like, women are told, oh, you need to see an obstetrician, you need to go and see an anaesthetist in pregnancy. But what are they doing? What are they assessing? And what are the pros and cons of that? It's all of these things are offers, but as you know, they're not presented as offers. But there wasn't anywhere that women and families could go to kind of weigh up the pros and cons of these sorts of things in relation to the evidence. You know, that women are frequently told they're offered aspirin. Low molecular weight heparin is another one. You know, what's that? Is there good evidence that that's beneficial? Do they, you know, what are the downsides? This is actually the question that I've been asked the most since I announced that I was writing this book. The question that people ask me most is, are you going to unpack the myth of the fat vagina? And the answer is yes. There's actually a section on that, because I know, but this is, you know, women are told that their baby is at risk and they may be more likely to have a cesarean if they have a higher BMI because they have more fat in their pelvis. You know,
yeah,
I know it's and you do have to laugh. I do have to laugh quite a lot about this. Not at what's happening to women. That's not funny in the slightest. But at the, this is a, just another area where you go and unpack this, and the emperor is still very, very naked here. You know, that women are told they need all these extra scans. What's the evidence for that? Is induction of labour really beneficial for larger women? You know, are women with a higher BMI genuinely more likely to have a problem labouring, or is something else going on there? You know, and what, why are you told you can't use a pool in labour? And, you know, what can we do? So I went and looked. That's why I've not been on for a while, because I've been really busy looking at the evidence for all of these things. Would it be helpful if I defined BMI and talked a little bit about the problems with the current approach?
Yes,
I think that would be so brilliant.
I would love to. So but it feels like the same story told over and over again. Like so many of the measurements used in maternity care and healthcare, BMI stands for body mass index, and it's basically a racist, sexist, classist index that was created a couple of hundred years ago by a Belgian mathematician who was trying to find a simple way of calculating the proportions of the human body. But this was in an aesthetic sense. So think, you know, Da Vinci's Vitruvian Man. That was what he was actually doing. He came up with this calculation. And it was basically an academic exercise. At no point did he say, oh, you know, and everybody, why don't you just use this for the next couple hundred years? Or actually, we didn't use it for 200 years. His name was Quetelain. And it wasn't his fault, to be fair, because he never intended it to be used to determine health. And it actually got forgotten about for decades until it was rediscovered by a rather controversial man called Ansel Keys. And Ansel Keys is somebody whose ideas have now become really central to what we call diet culture, which we can absolutely come back to if you'd like. But he rediscovered this, and it came to be used in healthcare, but it's not evidence-based. There was no evidence for it then or now. It's one of those things that was based on a few studies of mostly white men. It's not directly linked to health. BMI isn't a proxy for health. And yet it's treated as if it is in health and maternity care. So we have this idea that being larger is so dangerous and you're at high risk. And at any minute, you're going to develop all these things. You're at high risk of preeclampsia and gestational diabetes, stillbirth. You know, you better, like I said, you better have all these extra scans. But of course, because scans aren't very accurate, which Rachel and I have written about quite a lot between us, they tend to overestimate the baby's size. There's a good chance that the next thing, like I said, is, oh, you need an induction. Oh, and, you know, your baby's too big and you can't give birth in the midwifery unit. You're too big. You know, you can't use a pull because you're too big. I mean, most midwives couldn't lift an 8-stone woman out of a birth pool, you know, but.
But very good point. Especially from water to land.
Exactly. I mean, here's the thing. If we were going to stay on birth pools, which we have so many areas to cover, I suspect we're not, I could give you about 7 or 8 really good, logical, common sense reasons why the idea that, you know, larger women shouldn't go in a birth pool is ridiculous, harmful, not evidence-based. But here's the thing. I'm not saying this to you. I know you know this, but don't go thinking there's any logic to this because, as we know, logic and the obstetric paradigm are not exactly BFFs. These things are not logical. You know, and I mean this whole thing around how we treat women with a higher BMI in pregnancy, it goes hand in hand with the wider idea that larger people, you know, and I'm larger, we're all sort of walking around like we're going to fall over and die at any moment, you know, especially when Western medicine uses terms like morbid obesity.
That word.
Well, actually, that was a made up term. It was made up by a doctor who was selling weight loss surgery. So if you're listening and you've ever felt worried by being told you're morbidly obese, please try to stop worrying from this moment on, because it was basically a made up sales pitch, not based on anything except one greedy doctor trying to profit by making people fearful. It's disgraceful.
Gosh, marketing again. We had a recent podcast about that, Rachel, the marketing tactics that go on. And diet culture is another big business maker. So
it absolutely is. I mean, you know, I don't want to sound like a conspiracy theorist, but when you look at the wider evidence around health, weight and everything related to it, it turns out that a lot of this is rooted in profit. There are unspeakably large amounts of money to be made selling, you know, diets, wellness plans, courses, slimming groups, diet foods, weight loss injections, you name it. You know, and so we do have this set of ideas which we call diet culture. And these are ideas that many of us think are true, except they're not when you unpack the evidence. And there's now a growing body of evidence, which I've looked at a little bit in the first couple of chapters of the book, because I mean, it's a massive area. I can't cover all of it, but I think it's important that people reading the book know that there's a whole area of study now. And these ideas of diet culture, things like, you know, the idea that being fat is always bad. And if you are overweight, you need to diet. But also the idea that diets work, you know, is, you know, and it's a myth, actually. And almost certainly everyone that's listening to this we'll know somebody, maybe a couple of people, who is an exception to this. But when you look at the evidence on restrictive dieting, the evidence shows that restrictive dieting doesn't work in the long term for about 95% of us. And this is partly because of how our physiology works, you know, like with birth, like with so many areas. If you look at what we can learn from understanding physiology, it's actually in direct opposition to what we're being told by the medical model, you know, and in this case, by those promoting diet culture, because as you say, there's so much money involved.
Yeah. And then what we're doing is we're preying on minds during that antenatal period where you're looking, you're being told so much information, you're being frightened, and then you start searching or Dr. Googling, and you're coming up with the same information, which is just fear-mongering.
Absolutely. And, you know, and one of the things, one of the reasons I call the book Plus Size Pregnancy is people have said, you know, oh, is that the best title? And it's actually really hard to work out what is the best title. But what I wanted to make sure is that I was going, the book was going to be found by those who are Googling, you know, and hopefully, and that hopefully they will then realize that actually, because the people listening to the podcast know enough to be questioning these things and we'll see it as a resource. I want it to get out further.
Yeah.
You know, somebody said to me on, I think it was Instagram the other day, that when the book comes out, they're going to buy two copies. They're going to buy one for them and they're going to give one to the doctor who was fat shaming them. And I just think, what a brilliant idea.
Brilliant. Excellent.
Because it's a one-stop shop, Sarah, what you've written. Like, yeah, you could come there and you can get all the answers and sort of prepare yourself, whether you're pregnant or whether you're a birth, you're working in this space. But it's like you can come in and prepare yourself and kind of, as sad as it is to say, you can expect the questions or the opinions or the suggested route that you take prior to that happening.
Yeah. And actually, the one other thing that I feel like we need to mention at the outset is what's happening to women in maternity care and anyone who's larger, you know, more widely is weight bias and fat shaming. You know, somehow, and Rachel and I actually talked about this while I was writing the book, and somehow we've created a culture where it's deemed to be okay to shame people who have a larger body. Both generally and in healthcare, and health professionals do this a lot. And and people get away with this in contexts where they wouldn't get away with being racist or sexist or ableist or homophobic. And one of the reasons that they get away with being sizist or being, you know, trying to shame people that are larger is because our culture has this entrenched idea that being larger is intrinsically bad for your health. So it's okay, it's deemed to be okay to have a go at people who have a higher BMI because it's for their benefit, you know. And this happens so much in health and maternity care, and it's appalling, you know. And in what universe would it be okay to have a go at people for having any other kind of physical characteristic? You know, it's another of those areas that when you unpack it, you find that your mind is, you know, kind of blown. I mean, can you talk about what the groups that they have in Australia, Rachel? Because we talked about that a bit, not to put you on the spot.
No, put her on the spot. I want to hear this.
No, we were having a chat about the book and kind of my experiences. And, you know, this wasn't because I must have missed the big wave of it in Australia because I think I was out in private practice kind of when all of these groups, et cetera, came in. But, you know, I was hearing from women who were birthing in the system and midwives who were in the system that women being screened antenatally and then, you know, if they had a high BMI being put into these particular groups, this was a kind of new initiative where they'd have meetings and they'd be taught about, you know, diet and how not to be fat. And the women themselves called these groups the fatty club. You know, they were basically going to a club to be shamed and were just kind of taking that on board themselves and kind of had some camaraderie in that. But like, how awful is that, that you're going through your pregnancy and you've been diverted into a fatty club where they're going to teach you how to, you know, eat properly and look after your baby properly because...
Yeah, because you're already being deemed a bad mother subversively before you've even given birth.
And really, I was thinking... Right. So we're doing that. And then as I was saying to you, Sarah, like in private practice, it wasn't on my radar because there wasn't a difference in birth outcomes according to women's size. I just didn't see that. What I did see was when I was in the UK and working with women from a very low socioeconomic group who were often very underweight, that was a problem. But over here, when, you know, working with women who can pay for a private practice midwife, well-nourished, well-resourced women, the size of the woman had nothing to do with what. So I didn't even, It wasn't on my radar. Yeah, so I'm really pleased that you wrote this book, because as Katie says, all in one place. I haven't looked into it because I've kind of been a bit blasé because I haven't experienced it in practice.
We'll be right back.
I just wanted to pop into your luggles and tell you about my brand spanking new podcast, The Feeding Couch. This podcast ain't just designed with pregnant women or new parents in mind, but also for all of us working in the space of birth work. This is the podcast where I hand the mic over to a different mom, dad, parent, or even grandparent to take us on their feeding journey. Every story matters. It's often through hearing others' experiences where we find our own inner knowledge, strength, and courage. Listen in to hear the stories told of triumph, challenge, heartwarming, tear-jerking, fist-pumping, and how we each deal with our venture into this new world emotionally, socially, and physically. Whether you're a student, a newbie midwife, doula, lactation exam prepper, or just hungry for more knowledge, these stories will also give you a backstage pass to the global lactation clinic. Whether you're pregnant and seeking information or supporting those on their journey, I can't wait to see you on the couch with me soon. Oh, and a little favour, your reviews on Apple Podcasts mean the world. They're like magic beans that help spread the podcast out for those who need to hear it. Let's make this something amazing together.
But I also think it's really important to go a step further back, because there's a problem with making direct assumptions about weight and food and health and food as well. Because one of the things that really struck me as I was writing the book was that I was already aware of this, you know, multi-billion. I mean, I think I've got the statistic in here. Let me see if I can find it quick. No, I won't. I mean, the hundreds of billions of dollars is, you know, the diet industry is worth hundreds of billions of dollars. But there's also this, you know, this wellness industry, which says, oh, you need to eat these sorts of foods and you need to eat clean or you need to be vegan or you need to eat, whatever these things are. I think it's really important to be careful, because it's so easy to fall into this one size fits all approach, which, you know, I've written about a lot in a lot of different areas. And actually, there may be no one, well, I'm sure there isn't actually one perfect way of eating, of moving our bodies, of maintaining our health for everybody. You know, what's really interesting is that there's not enough evidence yet on what we could be doing instead in this area, not just in pregnancy, but in health and size generally, or whether we need to do, you know, anything at all. But, you know, that it's very clear that we need to move away from BMI being a measure of health. Metabolic health is a much better measure, but there are also other measures. And, you know, are people moving in ways that feel good to them? Are people eating in ways that are nourishing them as individuals? It's BMI is not about what you eat. And I think it's easy to say, oh, well, you know, we have people living in this area, you know, have these problems and they're not able to eat well. But I think what I'm questioning, or what, because of what I've read over the last sort of few years, is that actually we need to be really digging deep and asking questions about notions like, what does eating well actually mean? You know, and do our white middle class, you know, ideas about what that means, do they actually apply to everybody? How do they apply differently around the world? There are so many assumptions that we have to unpack, and we're just beginning to do that in this area. And that's when using these kind of single measures, really crude measures like BMI, it's absolutely ridiculous. You know, like, I mean, having a higher BMI is a bit like having a red car, because if you look at studies of car accidents and you say what colour cars are more likely to be involved in accidents, the answer to that is red. I should have got you to guess the colour actually at the beginning, you know, but here's the thing. Not everybody who has a red car is going to be involved in a car accident. And sometimes other colour cars, in fact, quite often other colour cars are more likely to be involved in a car accident. And if you take a random selection of car accidents that happen, actually more non-red cars than red cars are involved in a car accident every day. And all of those things and all of those things are true with higher BMI. Because I don't want to underplay and say, oh, no, look, these risks don't exist. Because there are some places where the guidance is absolutely plain wrong, inaccurate. Weight bias and weight shaming should never be happening for any reason. But the reality is that sometimes there is a slightly increased risk if you have a higher BMI of something, of gestational diabetes, of preeclampsia. But here's the thing. When you look at the absolute risk, you might decide for you, everyone's different, that it doesn't warrant the test or intervention, which also, you know, carries risks and downsides. But we have to understand that it's BMI in itself, again, is not a proxy for health. And so we've got to be more careful about the way that we talk about risk, you know, so that people, because the way we make it sound as if having a higher BMI means you're automatically going to get all of these things. You know, your outcome is going to be terrible. You're going to have a stillborn baby, and that's after your gestational diabetes and preeclampsia. Mm. And like with red cars, most women with a higher BMI will not have a problem. In fact, if they have a problem, it's probably more likely to be caused by the things that are done because they have a higher BMI than because of their BMI itself. So it's kind of because of their BMI, but it's the way people treat them. It's the way the system treats them because of their BMI. You know, lots of women with a so-called average or healthy BMI, which I acknowledge is a really problematic term. But if I'd stopped to say, you know, define that every time or explain why it's problematic every time, I would never have finished the book. I'd still be writing it now. Lots of people with a so-called average or healthy BMI have these problems. There is nothing that happens only to women with a higher BMI. If that makes sense. These are things that just happen to some women in pregnancy. It's just that you have a slightly higher chance if you have a higher BMI. But here's the thing, like with the red, I'm going back to the red car. I haven't yet done with the red car analogy.
Okay? I'm imagining a Ferrari, by the way.
Well, you can do that if you like. I was imagining like a little mini Metro.
That was one of my first cars.
I like mini Metros. Anyway, if you have a red car, it doesn't automatically mean you're going to have an accident. But there's another possibility that we have to look at. And this is why it's so important, as I go on about in so many of my books, it's so important to not just take the findings of the studies at face value, but to step back and look at the wider context and the bigger picture. Because what about if a certain group of people are more likely to buy red cars? What about if red cars are more appealing to, you know, because we know that statistically young men are more likely to get in accidents than almost any other age group. That's why they always want to put their mums on their car insurance, you know, because it brings down the premium. Yeah. So what about if there's a characteristic like being a young male, which makes you more likely to have a higher BMI, sorry, more likely to have a red car, and mixing up my metaphors here, and more likely to drive in a way that gets you into an accident? But I'm not about the blaming here. But again, we know that many factors affect BMI other than what you eat. In fact, what you eat and how you move are fairly low down on the list, because we know that BMI is affected by stress, by genes, by the microbiome, you know, by all sorts of things. So it is not a simple relationship where we go, well, what you eat determines your weight, and, you know, how often you exercise determines your weight. So there are almost certainly other factors, and stress is a really good example, which can affect BMI and can affect your chance of getting or developing one of these conditions that we, you know, we are concerned about in pregnancy. And like so many areas, it's just so much more complex than going, oh, well, you know, you're a bit fat, so you better go to Fatty Club and we'll lecture you on what to eat. You know, that there's no universe in which that's a helpful approach.
No. Has there been any research looking at outcomes for women birthing in the system versus women birthing outside of the system with high BMI?
No, not that I know of. And that's one of the things I know. I mean, we've talked about that. There are a couple of studies that I've talked about in the book that have shown that when women with a higher BMI receive midwifery-led care from, you know, nice midwives who aren't going about fat-shaming them, and or they are allowed, in scare quotes, to go and give birth in midwifery-led units, actually, their outcomes are loads better. You know, which is, you know, it's I mean, it's not really a surprise, is it? Because, you know, we know that one of the biggest risks that women with a higher BMI face is that they are more likely to have a cesarean. They're more likely to be told they need cesarean. Mm-hmm. But the thing is that all of the restrictions that we are placing on women, and that, of course, this sort of answers your question in a way, Rachel, because although there's no study on it, we can certainly extrapolate this from other areas. All of the restrictions that we're placing on women with a higher BMI mean that their increased chance of cesarean might not be anything to do with their size or weight or BMI. It might be everything to do with fat phobia, with the restrictions, with making larger women give birth in consultant units, whether or not that's what they want, and often they don't, where they end up with more intervention, more pain relief, more monitoring. There's no evidence for any of this. You know, they're more likely to be told they should have an epidural or spinal in labor just in case you need a cesarean. Because it might be harder to give you a general anaesthetic, there might be more risk, you know. So, but we're kind of, you know, we're setting up women to fail. You know, women with a higher BMI are more likely to have had their labour induced, because again, they've had more scans, they've been told their baby's bigger, even though it probably won't be when it comes out, because we're just as prejudiced against fat babies as we are, you know.
Sorry, but just a term, fat babies.
But that's what we're doing. I mean, macrosomia, yes, that's...
Exactly.
Sometimes we need to just kind of name it. And, you know, this is what we talk about, suspected larger babies, but it's baby fat phobia.
Oh, my God. That is such a good way of putting that. But yes, you're right. We have a huge fear of that.
Yeah, we're just as fat phobic about babies as we are about, you know, the adult women who are giving birth to them, you know. And so all of this intervention that we are applying and telling, you know, women with a higher BMI that they need, it can, you know, it means that they have an increased chance of being, of ending up with cesarean, you know. And of course, then we go, we told you need cesarean because you've got a higher BMI, but it wasn't anything to do with their size. It was the narrow care pathway and all the monitoring intervention and fat phobia. And, you know, I mean, if women want cesarean, I'm not criticizing that, you know, but what the evidence suggests is that many women who end up with cesarean may not have had one if they'd had better care. And so, you know, going back to Rachel's question, we don't have studies on this, but when I talked to quite a few people while I was writing the book, and every midwife who either is currently independent or has worked independently or who has worked in birth centres says the same thing. If you care for women and you don't fat shame them and you're not doing all this stuff, actually women, midwives aren't seeing, you know, that labour progress is slower or that cesareans are more likely. They're just not seeing that.
And yet we then do the kind of victim blaming thing in terms of a general approach, which is whenever you kind of bring up the increasing intervention rates, it's always the same story. It's because women are now more complex. They're fatter and they're older.
Yeah, exactly. You know,
it's that double whammy of then the women are being blamed for the increased intervention that's being put onto them because they are older and fatter, maybe, but we're putting those interventions in there, creating the outcomes, and then saying, see, look what you made us do.
It's your fault for being old and fat. And, you know, don't be black as well, my goodness, you know, or brown, crikey. You know, it is absolutely about victim blaming, where the problem is the system and the guy. Do you know, I feel like this is my third time in the cauldron, and every time I come and say the same things, and I'm very sorry about that, because I would love to rock up one day and be able to tell you, oh, do you know what, this time this isn't the problem, I found something else.
But it's not the same things that we keep finding, as something different. Yeah, but the thing is, Sarah, the more we've got you on, hopefully just one time this podcast is going to reach, you know, someone else who just goes, oh, let's have a look at this, and we start making some change in different areas.
Well, that would be nice. But I mean, I suppose what I also mean is that no matter what area of maternity care I dig into when I go and look at the evidence, it's the same story, which is we are using this one size fits all approach based on these ideas that are a couple of hundred years old, you know, which were developed by these, you know, rather unpleasant, you know, middle class white men who went, oh, you know, let's take over this area and control it. And these measurements are still being used today, and they're being applied across the board in a rather unpleasant way to all these, you know, women and families and babies. And we have so much evidence showing that this isn't working. And yet it's, anyway, don't get me going down that path. But it's just the same in so many areas. We need to go back and look at the physiology. We need to look at the evidence. You know, we need to look at the wider picture.
And I suppose that brings me to the fact that throughout the book, you actually interviewed quite a lot of people from quite diverse areas to make sure that you were looking at this kind of broader approach from right through pregnancy into the postpartum area.
I interviewed Rachel.
Absolutely.
Well, we called it an interview, but I mean, basically it's just Rachel and I having a regular rant on Zoom. No, I did. You're right. When I started out writing the book, this book took me longer to write than any book I've ever written. It's a longer book than any of my sort of recent books. And that's partly because of the, you know, breadth of the area. And I still feel I've only scratched the surface of the wider issues. But I knew from the outset, it's such a complex area and it touches every aspect of maternity care. So yes, what I wanted to do was to go to experts who specialise in various areas and make sure that I was as up to date as possible. But also, I mean, I can look at the evidence. It wasn't that bit that was the issue. It was about finding out what is happening in practice and what are women being told in different areas. I mean, like the groups that Rachel talked about in Australia, to my knowledge, I mean, nobody has told me that that's happening in the UK. It might well be happening in some areas, you know, don't write in, but that isn't, I think that's more of an Australian thing. So I wanted to find out what was going on. I mean, I received so many, I mean, I don't know whether people know this or not. I don't answer emails. I'm a very poor emailer. I realized a few years ago that I could either spend my time answering emails and, you know, chatting on social media, or I could write books. And I thought, do you know what? I'm going to write books. That's probably a better use of my time. Yay. So
thank goodness you did.
Yeah.
So I'm a very bad email replier. Sorry about that. I'm also a very bad social media comment replier because I've usually got my nose in a book instead. But what I do see is, like, you know, I have lovely people who collate stuff. And so what I could see was that there was this significant increase in comments that we were getting from women talking about their experiences and saying, this happened to me, I was told this. And I was thinking, this is absolutely not evidence-based. But yes, I wanted to talk to people working in different areas of the world and saying, what are the actual issues there? So, you know, I also talked to Katie about, you know, her experience as a lactation consultant. So you're in the book. I also talked to Amy Brown, who, you know, she is a friend of the podcast. I have her, I forgot to mention, I'm drinking from my midwife's cauldron mug. Got my tea in my midwife's cauldron mug.
Very impressed, and, Sarah.
Yeah. I've got to hand one over to Amy when I see her. So I talked to Amy, who, as I said, is an expert on breastfeeding research. But Amy also wrote about BMI and risk in her book, Informed is Best. And she's been also fabulous, because I've also been having this ranty conversation with Amy, who's you know, also really interested in this area. And, you know, in fact, Amy shared her story with me for this book. And she had hyperemesis with all three of her pregnancies. And she's written about this very openly, so I'm not sharing anything private. She had hyperemesis with all three of her pregnancies. And so she was losing weight because, I mean, hyperemesis is, you know, for anyone that doesn't know, is severe vomiting in pregnancy. She was losing weight because she couldn't keep anything down. And she found, brace yourselves for this, she found that some of her caregivers were actually congratulating her for this.
Oh my God.
Because her BMI was wasn't much over the so-called normal range, but severe vomiting made her BMI go into the normal range. And,
oh my God.
You know, and I mean, how nuts is this? You're vomiting all day. You can't keep anything down. You're really ill. You feel
you're
awful.
So sick.
But yeah, you've managed to get your BMI into what we consider the acceptable range. So, you know, well done you. I mean,
but that's the culture we live in, isn't it? In terms of not just within the pregnancy sphere, someone can go through a massive life change and they rapidly lose weight and everyone congratulates them. But actually they should be saying, oh my goodness, are you okay? Do you need some help or support? Because I'm worried about you.
Can I just tell you another story that's going to create ranty pants? I can't remember whether I told you this one, but it just came to mind. So there is I think he's retired now, but an obstetrician in Australia who promised women, part of his sales pitch was that if they followed his advice through pregnancy, then he would guarantee they'd be the same weight 6 weeks postnatally that they were at conception.
Oh my goodness. And I mean, this is so dreadful. And I mean, yesterday I accidentally, I never do this on purpose, when I was checking my Facebook page, I accidentally clicked on the news icon, you know, that shows you all the awful news stories, you know, and again, and it made me think of, because I knew we were recording today, and again, it's, you know, some celebrity who's all over her Instagram, and I am not criticizing, because women are under so much pressure to do this, so I really get that, but the message is, look, she's gained her body back, you know, she only had her baby 4 weeks ago, she's got her body back, how fantastic is she, well done you. Well, actually, you know, there's so much to unpack in there as well. These are the messages that our culture is sending out, or you know, the goal is to get your body back. Well, for me as a midwife, you know, as a holistic, mostly independent midwife, when I was, you know, practicing as a midwife, my goal for, like, you know, women and babies is in the first few weeks is, I mean, it's what they want, of course, it's not about imposing my idea, but ideally I think you need loads of skin to skin. You need to, like, Katie talks about making a nest in the book, to make a nest, you need to be feeding your baby, loving your baby, getting to know your baby, learning your baby, having that, you know, lovely baby moon time, if you can do that with your new family. It's not about, like, you know, how many days, how many hours have you been in the gym getting your pre-baby body back? And yet, again, these are the messages of diet culture and these expectations, you know, of women.
God, absolutely. It boils my blood.
It's so hard to concentrate. I just need to tell the listeners what I'm looking at and what Rach and I are looking at, because I'm sitting here trying to, like, make some serious, important, you know, clever points about plus size pregnancy, and Katie is sat with a tiny puppy and a little rubber bone on her. I'm going to do a screenshot. There we go.
Hello.
When the podcast comes out, go and look at my Instagram. Because I have a Katie puppy screenshot. Sorry, I've got no idea where we were, because I'm so distracted by
talking
by
about
the puppies.
Post body birth weight.
Well, I think I'm done complaining about that, to be honest. I think everybody gets this. I don't think this is news to people. No. It's just highlighting again that, you know, this is the problem in our culture, that, you know, that the things that we're focusing on are not at all, you know, the things that we should be focusing on. You know, we're telling women, oh, you're at high risk, but, you know, is that really true? You know, can I talk a bit more about risk? Can I rant a bit more about risk?
Yeah, because you've got a whole chapter on risk in the book.
I have, yeah. And because, I mean, as we said, there is a higher chance that women with a higher BMI will develop certain things. But, you know, going back to the red car, it doesn't mean everyone who's larger will develop them. You know, in fact, the vast majority of larger women won't experience those things. And I went to lots of effort with my calculator to go back to the studies, and where I could, I've calculated the actual numbers, because what we're given is population level data. And what we're usually given, we're usually told the relative risk. So it's like, well, you're three times as likely to get this if you've got a higher BMI.
Yeah.
But that's no help at all unless you know what the actual risk is. Mm-hmm. But when you look at the studies themselves, they're often not telling you, they're often not giving you enough data to work out what the actual risk is. You know, you have to go and dig into the studies, and there are several situations in which I can't actually get the data because the researchers themselves were not transparent about what the risks.
Wow.
So it's, you know, it is really frustrating because, you know, we need to look at the absolute risk, not the relative risk. We need to, you know, we need to look at other measures of health. You know, if somebody has a BMI of 40 and they have brilliant metabolic health and they enjoy moving their body and they take really good care of their physical and mental health and all that, well, their health is probably better than somebody with a BMI of 25 who doesn't take much care of themselves and rarely moves their body and has some kind of diabetes which they're ignoring and perhaps really poor blood sugar control. I am not saying any of that to pass judgment, but again, to go back to the fact that, you know, that health isn't effectively measured by size or shape, and the fact that our culture puts so much emphasis on this is really problematic. And I can't remember if we've covered this, but you said earlier, Katie, like, why are we using BMI still? And the answer is probably because it's easy. Yes. Because it's there.
Mm. Like so many things.
Yeah. But with the research, I mean, risk is a crude measure. Having looked at the evidence, I'm not convinced that BMI is even an independent risk factor for poor outcomes in maternity care. But the research itself is a problem in some areas because everyone says, you know, every researcher always says at the end of every study, oh, we need more research. Well, yeah, okay, we always need more research. But we don't just need more research of the kind that we've already got, because actually that's not very helpful. We need research that is more nuanced, that contains fewer incorrect assumptions, that is less fat phobic, that is more attentive to the problems created by diet culture, you know, because all of those issues they're exacerbating the problems and they're kind of perpetuating all of these myths. And frankly, they're leading to more intervention, which then becomes this self-fulfilling prophecy, which we've talked about. And it has this massive, no pun intended, knock-on effect on women, babies and families.
But this is how it works across the board, is that, you know, you look at a variation, you apply something general to it, and then you treat it like it's already a complication. So you do all these things that then actually make the complications happen.
Yeah.
Rather than looking at the woman holistically and is she healthy, is she well? Rather than, oh, you've got this particular factor that may or may not increase your risk for this particular thing, so we're now going to treat you according to this label, that means more interventions, more things that are going to potentially cause complications.
Yeah, absolutely.
So frustrating.
Yeah, it is. It is. And I mean, I suppose my hope is, because some people are going to say, oh, you know, I know all this. I know all these things aren't necessary. You know, do we need a book that says them? Well, I mean, hopefully, because otherwise I've spent a lot of time.
yes, we do.
But one of the things that I think is, I hope, will be really useful about the book is that even though there are lots of people who rant about this, which is fabulous, we need lots of people to rant about it, but the evidence isn't always there. And I think even every time I share a piece of evidence, there's always somebody that says, oh, we've always known this. Well, actually, sometimes we haven't always known it, I have to say. But even when we have, the fact is that we live in a culture that values science and evidence. And, you know, it is, I do know of stories, and this is a really positive thing. There are some positive things. We should cover some positive things. And one of the positive things is I know of situations, many situations actually, where, you know, somebody has taken one of my books or a piece of evidence or a piece of research or study to an appointment with a care provider who, you know, and has actually, they've been open-minded and they've said thank you very much, and they've taken the book away or they've taken the study away and they've come back and said, you are right, you know, I think it's important not to make the assumption that all care providers are, you know, getting up in the morning and going, I'm going to go out and disempower a few women today, you know. No. It's, you know,
no.
it, lots of the time, like with diet culture, I mean, one of the things that came up with I haven't written that much about women's stories in the book. I've shared a couple here and there, but actually in an earlier draft of the book, I had a lot of stories in there. And then I realized if I do this, it's going to be like a really, really fat book. The book itself is going to have a BMI of about 78. But I also realized, you know what, there are loads of fabulous books and people who work with women's birth stories. And actually, that's not really what I do. This needs to be about, you know, about the evidence. But when I was looking at these stories, what I learned is this isn't just about midwives or doctors. This is about birth workers as well. You know, I heard lots of women who said, you know, my doula was lovely, but I wish she hadn't kept talking about how she needed to lose weight before she was going on a holiday. You know, I wish she hadn't kept giving me tips on food, because I don't know whether she was thinking about that or not, but it felt like she was giving me weight loss advice. And every time I go to see a care provider, I'm given weight loss advice. And actually, that's the last thing I need, you know. And this is the thing about diet culture. And I'm not saying this to shame anybody, because we all do. I'm sure I do it as well. We have grown up with all of these ideas around us. And actually, care providers, you know, are also people. And often when you show them the evidence, you know, they'll go, oh, my goodness, I had no idea I was doing that. Mm. You know, I mean, that I don't want everybody to feel bad about doing it. But it's also really important to kind of be aware that this is, you know, these ideas, we've grown up with these ideas. We were taught these ideas as toddlers.
And but women talk about that in general everywhere, you know. You go to the staff room, there's just people talking about, it used to drive me bonkers. Like
the worst,
you
know, place for
whether
it.
They're being good or whether, you know, I'm being good today because I'm having this, or I was really naughty last night. Because that's how women interact with each other, you know.
Yeah.
One of the worst places I've ever found was tea rooms. A midwifery tea room was like, oh my God, I just can't take another day of talking about someone's new diet that they're on. Mm-hmm. And it would just be like, I'm just so bored. I might be on one myself, but I just want to talk about something else. It's within us. We have been flooded with it. We are even more flooded with it with social media and everything that's around us. Our culture is obsessed with how we look, how we portray to the world. And then to bring that within midwifery, pregnancy, postpartum, and how we work with women is incredibly important, and it needs to be discussed. And some of like what you say, some of it is almost like, oh my God, yeah, of course, this is obvious, but we need to open up the conversation and also go, yeah, I've probably been guilty of saying things like that, and I need to just have a look at how I speak, how I am, and where I can make some changes. And I think all of us can with everything. I mean, otherwise life would be boring if we just knew everything already. What would be the point?
Absolutely. You know, and it is really heartening that they're, you know, I mean, it was Black women, you know, some years ago who started, you know, the fat positivity movement and started saying, look, you know, actually, this is all really racist. These are all, you know, kind of, you know, white women's ideas of stuff. And these challenges to this kind of dominant rationality in our culture are coming from many different areas. And it's fab. In fact, towards the end of the book, I've said, you know, if these issues interest you on any level, please don't stop with my book, because all I've done really, I mean, it was all I've done. I mean, it was a lot of work, but all I've done is to go, look, this is what the evidence says in relation to maternity care. You know, these are that you do have a higher chance of some things that are deemed to be, you know, that you don't want. Actually, there are also some advantages to having a higher BMI, both generally and in maternity care. We can come back to that if you like. What I've sort of said is, you know, at the end of my book is, don't stop reading. Don't let this stop. You know, don't stop exploring, because this is actually, it's a really exciting area. At this point in time, when, you know, we're recording this in 2023, we are really only at the beginning of looking at some of the things that might actually work, not necessarily to reduce people's size, because it turns out that actually physiologically, our bodies aren't designed to lose weight. They're designed to put on weight, and they're really good at putting on weight in a sort of a famine situation. Unfortunately, our bodies can't tell the difference between an actual famine and you know, for instance, a government imposed lockdown where other people have bought all the pasta, you know, our bodies
and the toilet roll. Can't eat the toilet rolls though.
Well, and also, if you eat that much pasta, you're not really going to need much toilet roll, are you? But you know, so we need to far better understand what's going on physiologically. There's so much work to do, but I'm really heartened to see how much is already being done. You know, that there, yes, we have this kind of that. Yes, if you go to these, you know, changing rooms or what do you say, midwife's tea room, it made me think about like a little English tea room where it's just for midwives. Like,
that would be lovely, actually. I imagine nice posh cups and like a tray, like one of those tiers of like, you know, those little cakes where you put your finger out to eat them.
Like those cats tea rooms, like, you know, you can go to tea rooms now that have lots of cats in. You have to sign rules before you go. We haven't been because I shouldn't say, he'll never listen to this. We haven't been because Chris is really worried that he loves cats. Obviously, he's a very, very animal focused person. He's always worried that he wouldn't remember what the rules were, you know, with the cats. But you can
have... Sounds like it's a lap dance club, like you can't touch someone. No.
Well, I think it kind of is, actually. You can't touch the cats without their permission, you know. I'm not sure how one determines informed consent.
Put a $1 note in their knickers or something.
In their collar.
In their collar, yeah, that would make more sense.
I think anyone minds that we go off on all these tangents.
How did we get here? Oh my God.
Midwives tea rooms. Okay, I'm going to bring it back. It was me that went off on the tangent. I'm going to bring it back. So I was talking about in these spaces like changing rooms, and for me it's the changing room at my swimming pool. You know, I belong to a swimming pool and a leisure club, and several times a week I'm in the changing room, you know, and that's where women discuss their diets and what they're eating and how much exercise, and I'm just like, I'm just going to go and have a swim up and down and enjoy moving my body, because actually for me that's what's really important. Not, you know, when, you know, Amy and I talked about this a lot, how, you know, when you look at your tracker, I'm showing you my tracker as if everyone in the listening to the podcast can see my step tracker, but it's very disheartening when you when you've swum for, you know, we swum a mile and then it says you've burned 25 calories, you know. We need, and Amy's been posting about this because she's a runner, you know, and her Garmin, I think it was telling her off because she said it said that she'd done less exercise on Tuesday than any other day, but she was training, I think, for a half marathon, you know, so she'd done miles and miles every other day. And she'd only done, like, I don't know, 14,000 steps on Tuesday. And the Garmin was telling her off. And
getting shamed by your watch.
Wow. There's a reason I don't have one of those.
It's just nuts.
And you can't turn the calorie thing off. Because on mine, I'm like, I don't want to know how many calories I'm burning because it's bullshit anyway. And I don't want
exactly.
That. Tell me what my heart rate's doing when I'm doing the things I want you to tell me. But you can't turn it off.
Exactly. That's exactly my point about I've swum a mile and I feel good because it made my body feel good because, you know, that's my measure. Exactly. That's how I go when I'm stuck on my writing. I go and have a swim. You know, it's brilliant. It's kind of meditation. I'm certain it's good for my health. And I'm not the slightest bit interested in what it's doing to my weight or shape because that's not what it's about. But here goes my watch going, oh yeah, you burned 25 calories, which could
I can eat a quarter of a digestive biscuit. Thank you.
Well, except that we know that calories, I just need to say for the record,
it's bullshit.
We all know that. Yeah. Calories in, calories out was debunked. No, it's not that. I know you know that, Katie. It's just in case anyone's listening that doesn't know that and is going to write in to you and say this doesn't work. We know that doesn't work. But yeah, I don't want to know that because if I was focused on that, it's all a bit depressing, isn't it? To go, you know, you swam a mile, you felt really good, you've sorted it, you've figured out what the title of your next chapter is going to be, but oh, you've only burned 25 calories. We need to count the things that matter, count the things that count. Oh, here goes Katie again. Are you getting another puppy out or something?
Another one, like
another one.
Oh, like
in a tea room with puppies.
And that would be great.
Tea room.
Yes, but there's very strict policy. Oh, sorry. You can only touch them if they come up to you.
And you've got a dollar in your hand, or
no, the puppy is actually trying to grasp at the screens that I have that are made up of scarves and nice fabric. And she's gonna pull them down. But she's chewing on the wood bits, and I'm just hoping she doesn't wee. So
Can I'd like to ask a question now. I actually want to get Rachel's looking surprised. Don't worry, it's not you. I'm not putting you on the spot. I'm going to put Katie on the spot. Well, you can say no. This is an informed consent. we talked about breastfeeding, and I would love it if you would share, because I think these are your golden nuggets. Okay, what you were talking about with breastfeeding and ergonomics, because what we know about breastfeeding, I'll give you an intro. So what we know is that women with a higher BMI are less likely to breastfeed again. This is statistically, it does, if you're listening and you have a high BMI, there's no reason at all that you shouldn't breastfeed actually and succeed. And again, part of the problem is about the support that women are getting and what's going on in the wider culture. But Katie, we talked about the things that you know about as a lactation consultant as to how you can actually help women. And I just wondered whether, large women who want to breastfeed, and I wondered whether you would be up for sharing a bit of that.
Yeah, I think when we talked, I started talking and then I had to go and get both my dolls, because yes, for me, it's like show and tell. And also I felt really kind of almost confused when you were asking me certain questions, because how I approach, or how most lactation consultants, I hope, and midwives approach supporting breastfeeding, is looking at the individual woman, her shape, her breasts, her nipples, her baby, the size of her baby, if the baby's got any kind of restrictions in their movement from perhaps birth. And then, so the whole of breastfeeding is not just, right, there's 10 different positions we can use. It's an ergonomic factor. And so when I'm looking at an individual woman and her breasts, I'm going to think, well, where is this nipple pointing? Where is this breast sitting comfortably? Where is she comfortable? And how does the baby fit so that her arms, her shoulders, her breast is comfortable, so that we're not doing classically what happens if you do have larger breasts, regardless of size, is often we're kind of lifting our breasts up. Now I'm doing exactly that.
I was going to say, yes.
I'm lifting an imaginary breast, and then we put this pillow for the baby to sit on, and then like the weight of the breast then goes and pulls itself out of the baby's mouth. And often we end up with women having a classic issue, which is the baby sucking on the end of the nipple, and then we get sore, damaged, cracked nipples, milk stasis, baby's not having enough milk, baby's feeding really frequently, and of course we can see why breastfeeding goes down the drain hole, basically. But really, it's an understanding of, regardless of someone's size, it's looking at shape in terms of an economic, got a crying baby there, an ergonomic fit of mouth and breast. Oh my God, I'm just being the worst mother here because the baby is crying. But I think the biggest thing is to not go in with fear. And I think there is a lot of fear of, like, oh my goodness, I don't know how to kind of fit, in quotes, the baby to the mom, because all I've ever seen in the examples are these perfect, also in quotes, breasts, shape and size. Like, you look at any textbook, or you look at the images of babies breastfeeding, it is often the same woman, basically.
Yeah, with the same breasts.
With the same type of breasts. And this does not show us, and I am desperate, so I'm just going to put a plug in here, if anyone is happy to share images of themselves breastfeeding with larger breasts, with one breast smaller than the other, with a body that isn't the same as we're seeing, this is so helpful for training purposes, because it doesn't have to be hard. It's just about thinking slightly differently.
So important. And you talked a lot about, as I mentioned, making a nest, having skin to skin, and actually figuring out the patient. Again, it's the one size fits all. It's, not making the assumption that the pictures in the textbooks or the breastfeeding videos are going to work for. And this isn't just about BMI, it's about everybody being an individual, and actually the things that you said about, helping women with a higher BMI that I've sort of talked about in the book apply to everybody. They're not just about women with a higher BMI. It's like, you need to start by going, well, where do somebody's nipples point? Because that's the starting point. And actually, you could have, you know, you can have a higher BMI and not have large breasts. You know, there's no absolute correlation between BMI, breast size, nipple position, any of those sorts of things.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we say this every time. It is about individualized care, but it's also not going in with this kind of preconceived ideas of, and also fear. I think there is a fear around, you know, if you're on the maternity ward, you are often faced with the fact that a plus size woman has probably had a cesarean section. And as with any woman who's had a cesarean section, you just can't move very well for the first day or two. And so what happens with our breasts is if they are not just sitting there on top of them and pointing upwards, which let me tell you, most breasts don't, they're coming out to the side or they're going somewhere else. And you've got a woman who's pretty reclined and you're trying to attach the baby. There are so many ways of bringing pillows and maneuvers, and I've used chairs with their armrests to make the bed wider, all sorts of things. You can bring in their partners or the grandparents. I find it makes my job more interesting because I have to really go, ooh, how am I going to help with this? And also the fact that then we're getting to the point where this mother can do it herself confidently or as a teamwork. And that's a progression. And don't think that that's going to come immediately. And I mean, that goes for anyone who's had a cesarean.
And it's so interesting that you mentioned confidence, because I think that that's one of the things that is in the back of my mind with so many of these areas, that when, if we widen this out again and talk about what's happening, you know, with women with a higher BMI throughout pregnancy and labour and birth as well, because diet culture and the current approach is systematically undermining women's confidence, you know, and saying you can't do this, you're going to get this problem, you know, you can't do this, you need to be worried about your baby, you need all these interventions. I mean, this is absolutely undermining their confidence, you know. And I remember, I can't remember if this was Caroline Flint or Sheila Kitzinger who wrote about this. Many, I mean, this is back in the 1980s, so I can be forgiven for not remembering. But one of those fabulous women wrote about how what we were doing back then, and we're still doing it now, what we're doing in the maternity services at every point is undermining women's confidence, you know, taking women's confidence away, but with all of these things. And how ironic that is, she wrote, because this at the point where you become a new parent is the point where you need to feel the most confident in your whole life. Because all of a sudden, the midwives are going to go, or if you're at home, you know, the midwives are going to leave, or if you're in hospital, you're going to go home. And all of a sudden, it's just you and this baby. And, you know, and the last thing we want is for women in that situation to be feeling undermined, you know, traumatized, like, you know, they don't know what to do, like they've had all their confidence stripped away. And yet that's exactly what we're doing. We need those women in that situation to feel like, yes, I did this, and my body did this, and isn't my body amazing? Mm. We're not telling their body's amazing. We're telling them, you know, oh, well, your body's too fat, and so all these things are going to go wrong, you know, and it's your fault, and you've brought this on yourself. Yeah, exactly. But lucky we saved you with a cesarean section.
And that's why we need your book. And that's what your book is here for, to instill this confidence throughout the whole journey, the whole continuum, even into postpartum. And it's an essential resource. So everybody who's listening needs to have this book, and we need to get this out as far and wide as possible.
Thank you. And can I tell you something when you've gone? Sorry,
I was going to say before we end, can you tell us the advantages? Let's end on a happy high note.
Yes,
that was exactly what I was going to say.
What are the advantages of being larger?
Well, I'm not going to tell you all the advantages, because I want, you know, I want some things to be a nice surprise when you read the book. But I'll tell you one of the advantages: women who have a higher BMI, and actually this is an advantage in health generally, not just in pregnancy. Women who have a higher BMI, kind of by definition, have a higher blood volume. And so what that means is that we can lose more blood at birth without being compromised. So, yeah. And here's another one. There's a bit more detail on that in the book. And actually, I will say a bit more about the blood loss, because there are now guidelines and training guidelines in some countries which acknowledge this, which say, you know, look, you need to be, if you have a very slim woman, you know, you need to be more vigilant because, and I've ranted about this for years in relation to, you know, the birth of the placenta, which, you know, I wrote about quite a few years ago now. You know, it's not helpful just to say a PPH is 500 milliliters or is 1,000 milliliters, no. Because, you know, the reality is that all women are, you know, women are all different sizes. And and so a larger woman, as I said, can lose more blood before she is compromised, you know. And so another one is, do you know about the third and fourth degree tear OAC issue? Well, so women who are larger are far, far less likely to have a third or fourth degree tear. In some data, check the book, do not quote me, go and look at my book, because I one of the reasons I write books is because I do remember a lot of the numbers, but I can't remember all the numbers, so I write them in books. I think it's about 76% of the women in one study who had a third or fourth degree tear had a BMI that was either in the normal range or in the underweight range. So if you have a low or supposedly normal BMI, you are at higher risk of a third or fourth degree tear. I mean, I'm showing my age now by talking about them in that respect. If you have a higher BMI, having a higher BMI is protective against third or fourth degree tears. But we don't know about this. I mean, we don't get told about this.
No.
If you can see, if you go and look at the data, this is another reason that I actually went off and talked to experts in various areas. I mean, Julie Folick, who is a fabulous consultant midwife, who I've mentioned before because Julie's edited, you know, a few of my books. You know, Julie's a consultant midwife, and she and I actually sat down the summer before this one. That's when this started, summer 2022. We sat in my garden and we were talking about these things because, you know, Julie looks at this area and said, are you aware that this is in the data? And I can't remember if I was or not, but women with a higher BMI, less likely. And the other thing that Julie and I have to just mention this because Julie and I, there is no data going back to the birth pool issue, you know, because one of the things I've done is looked at, you know, how ridiculous it is that women are told you can't give birth in the birth pool. Julie and I actually went back to, we've estimated the actual risk of this, of, you know, of women needing help to get out of the birth, using, you know, large sort of actual data sets, because this isn't getting talked about. You know, when this is often the case where researchers find something in their research which doesn't kind of gel with the current mainstream narrative, they either don't publish it or they publish it but it's kind of buried, just waiting for me. This is kind of my version of golden nuggets, I suppose, waiting for me or somebody like me or Rachel, you know, to come along and dig it out, and then we kind of phone each other and go, did you know? So there are other positives as well, but I'm going to leave those as little surprises for when people read the book. But there are definitely advantages. That, you know, there are advantages in health generally. There are, in terms of recovery from disease, you know, people with a higher BMI have better recovery from some diseases, you know, in older age. And I mean, it makes sense because we've got extra weight because our bodies were going just in case there's a famine. And actually, like I said earlier, our bodies can't differentiate different kinds of famine, you know, and having chemotherapy is a kind of famine. Having, you know, other treatments is a famine. And there we are with our greater resources and, you know, with, yeah, that our bodies can draw upon. So the advantages of having a higher BMI do not get talked about, but perhaps they should.
Absolutely, perhaps they should. And here they were, and there's more to come. I think that's a great place to end, because it's leaving people wanting much more, and they can find it in the book. So I want to say a huge thank you, Dr. Sarah Wickham, in the cauldron today with us. It has been a blooming pleasure. Thank you
for having me.
Ta-da!
I hope you found a few golden nuggety nuggets in the show today. Please don't press pause, but instead scroll on down on your podcast app. Yep, that's it, down there.
and pop a review and maybe a few stars to make our eyes twinkle with glee. For more on breastfeeding and lactation content, head on over to my website where my course is. And for courses and books from Rachel, you can find everything in the links below. So all I gotta say now is, here's the bloopers. Good morning. Rachel, I haven't started yet. Rachel, do you want to do Sarah's introduction?
No.
For a change.
Great.
Yeah, Sarah, you've been here like this is the third time now. You don't need the introduction. It's just like, right, get on with it. Let's ask you the questions.
Off you go.
Well, you do your blurby bit. You do your blurby bit at the beginning that covers it all. So what do you want me to say?
I don't know. Maybe you could start with hello. Welcome to the cauldron.
Go on, say something about me, Rachel, whatever you like.
Oh, well, I mean, you're just fabulous, Sarah.
This is such a great start. I'm just going to say hello.
It just feels weird because I'm usually chatting to you about, you know, you're giving me
having a little rant about
good advice and rants and gossip, and it just feels a bit weird that this is public, so better be careful what I say, hadn't I?
Right, I'm starting then, if you two are all right. Like that.
Oh, thank you very much. Sorry.
You're going to have fun editing.
I know, I'm really sorry, Katie.
Don't worry, I'm just waiting for Rachel to drop out mid-sentence as well, and then I've got to cut that as well.
Well, I don't say anything, so it'll not be mid-sentence, will it?
You do say things, you've got questions, everything, haven't you?
Well, go on, sorry.
Right. No, please say more, Sarah, because all you got was hello and then a cough and then we started talking and I've got to take all that out of the editing.
I can ask a question.
Go on.
Wait, right. Hold on, guys. Wait. What happened then was we did an intro. Sarah said hello. Then she coughed. Then we had a bit of it. I've got to cut all of that. So I want you to go back from you saying more than just hello.
What? Welcome.
I'm just going to say, Sarah, welcome to the cauldron.
Thank you. Oh, so. Again, and I promise I'll say hello this time.
Sarah, welcome to the cauldron.
He's sign languaging at me for?
Because you said, I'm asking a question, so I'm waiting for you to ask it.
Well, it seems a bit weird to just come in now with a question.
Because I'm going to cut it all. Oh, okay. Now I'm just like, this is bloopers.
Right. All right, so we're just going to go and
pretend nothing's been said, and just as if you're starting after Sarah said hello.
We're going to need another cup of tea.
Oh my God, I need directions. I need to put director, producer, editor.
See, I've got a professional microphone, but that's the only thing that's professional.
Yep. Wondering which of my courses is for you? Breastfeeding and Lactation, the Fundamentals has been designed for everyone working in the birthing field or those on their journey to becoming breastfeeding specialists or IBCLCs. This course gives you 7 hours of CPD and is packed with reflective learning, case studies and some pretty tough, at times, quizzes to make sure this stuff sticks. It also means you can meet me monthly in my live Q&A. This is my course that I hope will fill in the gaps that traditional breastfeeding education has left out. I want you completing this, feeling confident to support any breastfeeding or lactation challenge of those in your care. But wait, I have another course called The Feeding Couch. Who's this for? Currently, around 80 to 96% of women decide to breastfeed during their pregnancy, but by just 8 weeks after birth, a third to almost 50% of those women have stopped breastfeeding. And of those women who stopped, 80% say they stopped breastfeeding before they wanted to. Learning about breastfeeding during pregnancy has been shown to improve breastfeeding self-confidence and improve the rate of exclusive breastfeeding in the short and the long term. I believe every mum should be able to choose how she wants to feed her baby and for how long. Knowledge is power. That's why I created the Feeding Couch, designed to be watched during pregnancy or for new mums and parents who may be struggling right now with breastfeeding. The content is in step-by-step, binge-worthy whilst pregnant or for those most tired of days postpartum. Totally easy to find exactly what you need and dip in and out when you need a breastfeeding answer quickly. And for you beautiful podcast listener, there is a 10% discount off both courses when you use the code POD10, that's P-O-D-10, at checkout. To find out more, hop on over to my website, katiejames.site, and have a look at the incredible content waiting for your lucky peepers.